Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where we have reached the letter P. My name is Tom Butler, and as Brendan is still currently moving house, I've recruited not one but two rogue agents to tackle the filmmakers and characters of the Bond world that fall under the 16th letter of the alphabet. So, returning for his second appearance on the podcast is the author of Catching Bullets, Memoirs of a Bond Fan. It's the personable and popular Mr. Mark O'Connell.
Hey, I like rogue agent. I'll live with that. I'm going to get that tattooed somewhere. So, yes. Hi, everyone.
And making his long-awaited James Bond A to Z podcast debut, it's the brains behind the popular cinema savvy YouTube channel. It's the playful and proficient Mr. George Aldridge.
Lovely to be here, and proficient, I will take that.
So if you've been listening to the podcast the last few weeks, you'll know that we're after your underappreciated James Bond movie moments for our 60th anniversary special. So if you are wanting to get involved, do an audio clip under 2 minutes long telling us who you are, what the moment is, and email it to us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk, and we will include those in our anniversary specials. So let's crack on with the podcast. There's a preposterous amount of topics to cover tonight, including some popular characters, some powerful creatives, and we'll be paying a visit to the home of Bond. But to kick things off, there's a young lady in Santiago I want you to meet, George.
Yes, Pete for Paloma, of course, played by Ana de Armas, and introduced in No Time to Die that was released last year, a CIA agent based in Cuba. And of course, she joined James Bond on the mission at the start of the film. One of the scene-stealing moments from the film, I think a lot of people would be in agreement with, and with it being essentially one scene we had her for, there's not much known about the character before or after it takes place. And what is fascinating is that we know she's had 3 weeks worth of training, which is a very big moment for a lot of people. And I guess we can also say with this, I know you covered it on the episode on No Time to Die, originally it was meant to be Felix Leiter that joined Bond for the Cuba set pieces.
Do you think 3 weeks training is that she's only joined the CIA 3 weeks ago, or that she's been training for 3 weeks for this specific mission?
That's a very good question. I feel like it's been 3 weeks worth of training since being in the CIA. That's how I've envisioned it. I don't know if I'm by myself in that theory, but I'm interested that it might have been for that one single mission.
Because it is a bit of an ad hoc mission, isn't it? So that line's always confused me a little bit. It's a funny line, but that's confused me a little bit.
Well, I wonder if it's almost Phoebe Waller-Bridge putting in that, oh, she's only been in the job for 3 weeks, and then she does this amazing sequence. I mean, the whole bounce of that set piece is like, I was chatting with someone yesterday, and they said, if Bond 26 can be like a two-hour version of that Paloma sequence, then we'll be off to the races in rather brilliant style.
Yeah, I paid that money to see that.
I think a lot of people wouldn't. Tom, we were at the premiere as well, and all of that scene had the big cheers. A lot of people were sort of invigorated in those opening scenes, and for the sort of opening third of the film, I think it was a very good way to get started. Obviously, to some, it never peaked past that moment, but it's a really interesting conversation piece for No Time to Die, and I guess, you know, almost a year on since it's released, it's still spoken about, and I would say she's gone on to become an immediately iconic character.
Absolutely,
and
she's
actually doing quite well, you know, in sort of Hollywood. She's got the Marilyn thing coming up, The Grey Man, Night Clerk. She's kind of, not every Bond actress launches, but sometimes often the ones that become like Eva Green, they're sort of their moment was already starting when they did Bond, and I think that was definitely the case with Armus. And it's a joy to see her sort of carrying on. I think she might be a name we'll all know about for quite a while.
Absolutely. I'm just going to go over her costume as well. So we did a bit of research on this, and I've mentioned iconic today. I think the image of her with the guns was across the entire marketing campaign in the dress. And what was quite interesting researching this is that this fashion designer Michael Lasordo designed the dress originally for the series Schitt's Creek. Now, I've never seen this, and it was for a wedding with the character of Alexis.
Oh my god!
And they love that redesigned. Show. Are you familiar with it? Because I've never seen it. So,
and now you've said that that is totally the thing. The whole show is actually very predicated inadvertently on costumes and not outlandish costumes for a lot of the women characters, but it's very aware of its costume choices. Sorry to cut in there, but that's a brilliant bit of triv there.
No, it's really interesting sort of finding this out. And what they essentially did, the main redesign was, of course, the change of colour to midnight blue. And what surprised me more than anything in this era of the 007 store and their incredible prices, you can actually purchase the costume from this film directly from the designer for $1,790 Australian, which equates to around just over £1,000 in here in the UK, which I think is about £200 more expensive than Odd Job's hat, which is a very surprising and random bit of trivia. But I've also found some comments from the costume designer for the film. Apologies on the pronunciation there, Satira Lalab. And she essentially spoke about the costume she created for some of the female characters. And she said, they are strong, self-possessed, important, plot-driving women, all in their own right. And this was a really fantastic opportunity to be able to put a stamp on those kind of female characters in a Bond film. There was a lot of positive reinforcement and female awesomeness that was so present with this film. It was so heartening for me to be able to, in this moment, be the person with dressing these strong female leads. And that was in an interview with Forbes from last year before the film came out.
Yeah, I mean, that costume, it's fantastic. There's definitely a touch of the Pam Bouvier about it, in that, you know, she can wear it to a cocktail party, but then also wear it to for kicking ass. And as her character's only on screen for one scene, really, they really made the most of it, I think.
Yeah, and taking a look at Ana de Armas herself, and the first thing I discovered, her forename is actually Ana Celia de Armas Caso. So I can understand why that was shortened for a stage name for her career. And for those unfamiliar, she was born and raised in Cuba. She had grandparents from Spain and later moved back to Madrid at the age of 18 to pursue her career in acting. And what I found fascinating was that she took part in a four-year university course in studying drama. And in Cuba, after 4 years of a degree and you graduate, you have to do 3 years of community service, which definitely has a different meaning in Cuba than it does in the UK. And that she left just a few months before the degree finished, so she didn't have to do that and could move to Spain, which I found fascinating. So obviously planning that in the pipeline. And her big breakthrough in Spain was a Spanish teen drama called El Internado. Translation is The Boarding School. And she starred in 6 of the 7 seasons of the series and was asked to be written out of the show due to being typecast in Spanish roles as teenagers, and then would go on to move into LA in 2014. Now, I don't know if anybody's seen any of her Spanish films or series beforehand, but it's quite an interesting career move for her.
No, not seen any of her Spanish language stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. And obviously moving to LA in 2014, essentially she got a Hollywood agent when she was in Spain. So she was able to move to America after 2 months of there. And what was it's been on the news recently with some of her interviews in the build-up to The Grey Man coming out. She mentioned that she had to learn her lines phonetically for auditions and actually in her first few films. So the first one she did was Knock Knock, which was released in 2015, directed by Eli Roth, and it stars Keanu Reeves. This was her sort of first American language film. Now, I haven't seen this. I've heard of it, but I know, Mr. Butler, that you have seen it.
I have, yeah. Mark, have you seen that one?
No.
So it's like it's like a home invasion type movie, but it's sort of turned on its head. So, you know, obviously it's normally teenage girls and the guy like invades the home, but this is like the guy at home on his own, and his house gets invaded by two sort of teenage girls, Ana de Armas and another girl, and they sort of prey upon his male instincts and sort of start seducing him. But then like, yeah, they're obviously there for other reasons. And it's actually a really, it's a good little thriller, actually. It's got a great ending, I seem to remember. Mm. She's really good in it, really memorable.
And then after that, she was in War Dogs, which is a Todd Phillips film. And what I found fascinating, she did an interview in 2019, The Hollywood Reporter, talking about the audition. And she said, I wasn't really sure what I was saying. I didn't want to audition for Maria Jr. and Lola and all those kind of things. I wanted to audition for the same parts that everybody else is auditioning for. Which is very interesting, because when we see stories of sort of foreign actresses coming through to come over, not speaking any language, but learn it phonetically, I think it's not just fascinating, but it's a real credit to her that she was able to do that. And she ended up taking a 4-month full-time English course to sort of improve her language skills during sort of War Dogs' filming as well, which again, I think is fascinating for someone sort of so young in another country, just learning English on the cuff whilst already being in the industry. I've not heard a story like that before.
The phonetic thing, it was also what allegedly Javier Bardem had to do to get through Skyfall. A lot of his lines were phonetically worked out, because he's not always had the best English or, you know, the best grasp of it, saying that my Spanish is terrible. So he's doing a lot better than I am.
And I guess we could say her big breakthrough role was playing Joy in Blade Runner 2049, directed by Denis Villeneuve, and released in 2017. Obviously, Ryan Gosling also starred in that, another companion from The Gray Man. But we bring that up quite a few times because there's some other actors that do pop up. And after Blade Runner, she would also go on to have the leading role, which I think was the real breakthrough, in Knives Out, of course, Rian Johnson, released in 2019, opposite Daniel Craig. Which I find one of the most fascinating stories about Paloma, because if I'm being blunt, if Daniel Craig hadn't have had the injury that meant he could shoot Knives Out, I don't think we'd have had Paloma in Bond. I don't think we'd have had Ana de Armas in James Bond, which I think is a really sort of fascinating twist of fate for maybe one of the most cursed Bond films ever made.
Was it the injury that delayed it? Or was it Danny Boyle leaving that delayed it?
Oh, no, apologies. It was Danny Boyle, because then he was able to shoot it in 2018, end of 2018, apologies. It wasn't leaving gap.
Yeah, no, it was because I remember what happened. Yeah, the film got delayed, and then all of a sudden there was this hot project with Rian Johnson, and then all of a sudden Daniel Craig was in it. It felt like, I think he probably really needed it as well at that stage. Yeah, it was kismet, wasn't it, that they met on the set. And I think possibly she knew Cary Fukunaga already. I think I read that somewhere. So I think it was the combination of those two things that led her to be in No Time to Die.
Yes, so Cary spoke to her about being in No Time to Die. She came to Pinewood to audition for the role. And at the same time, she met Phoebe Waller-Bridge's, and she actually spoke in another interview saying, lucky me, all my scenes were written by Phoebe. My dialogue and the energy of the character really comes through, like Phoebe comes through. The woman I'm portraying is different than previous Bond girls. It has some bubbles in it. It's really fresh and exciting. And I think that's also one of the great things people spoke about with this film, is you can tell what scenes were written by Phoebe, which does make a difference from some of the other writers on the Craig era. And I just think it adds so much more life to the film.
Without doing that feminist in spotlight sort of thing, she's not doing that. She's kind of bringing up everyone's lines and dialogue. There's a pace to what she does. I always find her economy of punch really brilliant. And I was one of the happiest people when I found out she was doing the No Time to Die.
I've heard that she might be, well, the rumour was that she was having a bigger role on Bond 26, but yeah, I wonder if that will come to pass.
Or Indiana Jones 6. Let's see. I saw, so I'm sure it's right. There's the problem with these films that are so delayed, and then, you know, COVID and restrictions and production delays kick in. It widens that terrible rumour canyon even more. And I'm sure I read or saw some notion that the Indiana Jones is going to, the baton is going to be handed on to Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I would take that with a pinch of Tunisian sand, but we shall see.
That's one of the interesting rumours. And not too long till I guess we get a first trailer with that at D23. And talking Ana de Armas, kind of very quickly post No Time to Die, obviously it's a very recent film. She starred in the erotic thriller Deep Water, released earlier this year, directed by Adrian Lyne, starred opposite Ben Affleck. And obviously, for anyone unfamiliar, they had a very public relationship that went viral during lockdown. And due to the media sort of following her with that, she actually left LA and moved and now resides in New York, which is completely fair play to her. And at the time of this video coming out, The Grey Man will now be on Netflix, which she stars in, of course, opposite Chris Evans and Ryan Gosling, a potential spy franchise for her to be involved in long term. And I guess the big one is going to be September the 23rd is the film Blonde, the Marilyn Monroe biopic, which I think is getting a premiere at either Venice or Toronto Film Festival. And I'd imagine there's a lot of people thinking there might be an Oscar campaign for her if it does end up being good.
Yeah. I mean, from going from being doing lines phonetically to portraying one of the most famous women in Hollywood, it's quite a journey for her, really.
Well, both spent time at Pinewood doing pivotal roles. So there is some sort of crude linkages there, maybe.
Of course.
Yeah. And I've got one final thing to end on is a great quote from the magazine called C, which she'd interviewed last year. And she said, "I never thought I was going to be a Bond girl. I never thought I was going to be Marilyn Monroe. To even think that I was going to work in anything to begin with was pushing it. But at the same time, I guess I kind of knew it could happen because that's why I ultimately moved to LA," which I thought was a really nice way to sort of end this segment with her and potentially where her career is going to go, because no doubt she will be an A-lister. And it's going to be very exciting to see what film she does do next.
Right, to Pinewood.
So Pinewood Studios has always been the golden movie palace of film production and obviously Bond film production. I am deeply besotted by the place and love it dearly. And if you can ever get there, it's increasingly harder to do that at the moment in the current sort of Disney regime and the restrictions, because you used to be able to sort of wander around a lot more freely. I remember going there in 2008 and kind of slightly wandering on and off the sets of Quantum of Solace, which was bizarre. And at one point, I didn't even know I was on the one of the rooftop sets. But the studios, they've been a pivotal gem in the British movie production. I call it the studio belt of home counties. You had your Bray Studios, your Elstree, your Shepperton's. But for me, Pinewood is still the golden child. It was opened September the 30th, 1936. I remember that because it's my birthday. Well, the September 30th bit, not the 1936. and there was a guy called, I think it was Charles Boot, and there was originally mansion that they built these sound stages round. And the mansion there was a book done by George Perry in 86 on the 50th anniversary, and it was called Movies from the Mansion. And the Heatherden Hall Mansion has always been quite a pivotal hub of Pinewood. But they built the sound stages around it, although unfortunately Second World War kicked in, and just as the studio was starting to get some business, I think Green for Danger was its first title at the time, it had to shut down production. And then I think it became a little adjunct of the Royal Mint, and there was a famous quip, "Oh, at last Pinewood is finally making money." So it was used a lot in the war. In fact, a neighbour of mine, her grandfather was building wooden planes in the prop department at Pinewood during the war. He sadly fell off a wing and later died. So he's got a weird claim to fame that he died at Pinewood Studios on a war plane. But they would use the studios, not just Pinewood, but they would use the studios during the Second World War to build prop planes, because there was a lot of fake airfields dotted throughout the southeast, and they, if they needed a wooden fake Spitfire that the Germans could blow up, they were often built by the studio technicians at Shepperton and particularly Pinewood. But Bond's history kicked in February, I think it was February the 26th, 1962, when the production left Jamaica and came back to Pinewood. Cubby Broccoli, the producer, and Harry Saltzman, the producer, had already had some history with Pinewood. Saltzman had shot The Iron Petticoat there, and Cubby had done his Warwick film Hell Below Zero, plus others. So it was on their radar. And at the time, Pinewood was also the home of the Carry-Ons, which started 3 years before Dr. No, the Doctor series, one or two Hitchcocks, and some kids' movies. And it was an affluent, well, Pinewood has never been affluent. I think perhaps it's doing okay now, but Pinewood always struggled. But Bond came in and set its home up in the various studios there. And, you know, to a degree, the rest is Pinewood history. They've used the grounds and, you know, every corridor, tree, hedge, an entrance within the whole studio set has been used in different Bond films, famously for Rush with Love's overture is Spectre Island, which is Heatherden Hall, the mansion that I mentioned before. Octopussy was the ambassador's residence there. A View to a Kill. I got married at Pinewood and I wanted to name each table after something that was not just shot at Pinewood, but shot in the room we were in, that we were in the Heatherden ballroom. And the day after, I found out that View to a Kill was shot just in the side pool room there. I was like, do you know how much I would have wanted as a 85 to have the top table called A View to a Kill? We went with Octopussy, which was quite fun for the mother-in-laws to sort of, oh, we're on the Octopussy table. What's an Octopussy? Like, it doesn't matter. It's a film. It's fine. It's a film. But yeah, View to a Kill shot there, because View to a Kill, famously, there was a big production space shortage, because after Ridley Scott's Fire, somewhat, the Legend set, which was a big forest fantasy set that Ridley Scott had there in the summer of 84, kind of caught fire one lunchtime and destroyed the stage. So they were suddenly without space. To be fair, Peter Lamont spun it around very quickly and they regenerated the phoenix from the flames that is the 007 stage, because it's kind of had quite a few flames over the years. But they used the pool room for the Zorin fighting scenes with Mayday, the sort of kickboxing.
Is that right?
Training. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And there's this weird moment. We used that room as our green room for the wedding. And I was looking at this water fountain going, I've seen this water fountain somewhere. And then the next day, a friend said, this is the room where Mayday's hand, you know, the water fountain's in frame and her hand kicks in. And then the whole sequence. And I was like, oh my God, why did I not know that? So sorry, a View to a Kill tangent, but that's why you have me on. Goldfinger was shot down one of the alleyways there. It is now, you know, There's Goldfinger Avenue. And the studio has named little bits and pieces after Bond over the years. More recently, we've got Skyfall Avenue and Michael G. Wilson Way, or I can't remember what that title is. And that's part of the new set. So opposite the original gates of Pinewood, on the other side, it's kind of almost doubled its size, partly because of the Netflix infrastructures that are now using Pinewood Shepperton, but also Disney. They've used it and it's great. And I suppose the pinnacle stage that we all want to shoot a movie in if we're Bond fans is the Roger Moore stage, which was set up in October 2017 as a memorial to Sir Rog. But yeah, a big Pinewood fan. It's had its problems. I mean, a bit like Bond kept... You could claim that Bond kept British cinemas open in the 70s. You know, the Odeons owe a massive debt to Roger Moore in the 70s, but also the production of Bond in the late 70s and early 80s arguably kept Pinewood afloat. There was one time, again, another neighbour, his dad used to work at Pinewood, and he said he went there in 83 when they were shooting Octopussy, and he could walk around the sets of Superman 3 and Octopussy, and then not long after Supergirl. With that, and it was just literally they were, because it was so unoccupied, it was just really easy to chill and move around there. Less so now, but that's good. It's being used. That's why it's harder to walk around there. Pinewood continues to be the Bond hub, the production hub. It's quite a spiritual base for the Broccolis. They don't always have to shoot there. Moonraker in 78, 79 chose facilities in Paris for various tax reasons. And obviously in 88, 89, when License to Kill was shooting at Churubusco in Mexico, Pinewood wasn't used, but it's always been used in post-production and editing and sound mixing. So I think every Bond film has probably got a Pinewood thumbprint on it somewhere.
GoldenEye, I guess, is the other famous one that shot at a different studio, isn't it? Because,
But even so, there was a lot of, reels taken back and worked on back. Yeah, they tried it. I mean, there was this, I remember, it doesn't kind of get remembered so much, but when also Tomorrow Never Dies found it difficult to get studio space, so they got the I think it was a Rolls-Royce factory at Frogmore, no, Rolls-Royce factory at Leavesden, but there was another factory at Frogmore and it was called Eon Studios for the duration of some shoot. And I was like, oh, Eon Studios, that's what they should call Pinewood now.
George, you've worked at Pinewood as well, haven't you?
yeah, it's an incredible place. It's film history. And I was very fortunate to work for a company there for a year. So they resided there. It wasn't directly for Pinewood. And I've just got to say, it was the highlight of my job every day for a year. You know, going to Pinewood Studios to earn a living working in the film industry, that was just incredible. And, you know, not just growing up as a Bond fan, but a fan of that industry, knowing that as a big Star Wars fan I am, there were Star Wars films filming there whilst I was there. You can't help but take it in every single day of there. If the weather's great, you get to walk around the gardens. And you walk around the gardens and you think, I recognize this from this film or from that film. And Mike, you mentioned Heatherden Hall, our offices were in there. So where, you know, we'd come out and that's where, you know, weddings would be there at the weekend, or there'd be private parties there as well across the week. And it's just incredible. And it's exactly what I said, you know, it is harder to go in there. I was very fortunate that I was able to get back in there last year on the day of the Bond premiere. That was a very, very fun moment. And even from a sort of 2 year gap to leaving to going back, you could see how much has changed. But what I'm very excited for is with the expansions, they're going to be building they haven't confirmed it as a museum or an exhibition per se, but there is going to be a area for general public people to finally get the chance to visit. But of course it will be in the new buildings. It won't be the historic landmarks. People won't be able, say, as you said, you can't go to Goldfinger Avenue, which, you know, you just, if anyone's had the chance to go there or has seen it on behind the scenes footage, you look down the street and you just know it's the scene from Goldfinger. And it's taking in history, and again, just being there, part of the process. There's nothing quite like it. And you know, I, even with no time to die to jump to it, the day the explosion happened at the studio, I was actually ill off work, so I saw it on the news and just checked in with like everybody I knew. And you know, there's different stories from everybody, and it's history. Just being there, you know, knowing that you're working on something, or something, you know, is filming there you might not be working on. And that's going to be a story as time goes by. And it's just an incredible, not advert for the British film industry, but it's an advert for the film industry as a whole. To me, I don't think any studio in the world can stand up to it. And I think anyone in production would probably say the same thing.
Yeah, that you're right. There is an atmosphere there. It's not just that, oh, they might be doing a Bond or a Star Wars or an Indiana Jones. When you walk around, I remember when I first walked around, I worked there on a comedy show that was using the studios there. And I was so made up when I saw the call sheets. I was like, oh, are you okay getting to Pinewood for 3 weeks? I'm like, yeah, I'm all right getting to Pinewood for 3 weeks. And you walk around and it is like you're on that, in that opening scene of Roger Rabbit, where it's just golf carts and costume rails. And suddenly you see someone dressed as a Victorian urchin and a robot. And it is kind of that, everything you want a film studio to be. Plus the noise and smell of carpentry and timber was quite a thing. Constant noise. No wonder, you know, there's sound sound dubbing booths, because you'd never shoot there silently. And it's just, you just look around and you, like you say, you just see all these little echoes of, well, not just Bond, but Carry On and the Doctor series. And I'm excited about the Pinewood Experience studio tourist thing that's opening. I think possibly some of its tourist promises and ability to kind of tread the Bond path might ultimately not fully be as touted, sadly. But it's great that it's expanded. You know, there was always this contention about, oh, we can't build on Greenbelt. I'm like, I've driven round the fields around there. It's fine. Okay, we put worse things on Greenbelts, and it's, you know, it's a mass, like you say, it's a massive addition to the filmmaking, you know, infrastructure of the world. You know, when Disney, Spielberg, Harrison Ford, when they're using it, you know, or James Mangold, when they're using it for Indiana Jones 5, that there's a reason for that. They could shoot anywhere else. They could shoot in America cheaper, but they know the artistry and the crews are great. And I love when I have reason to walk in there and just mingle. It is just a beautiful place.
I was going to say that you've mentioned the people there, because Pinewood obviously is more than just a set of big buildings with big lights and green screens in it. It's the history of Pinewood is that they used to have, you know, all the technicians were part of the studio, weren't they? And then you would go and use all the different departments or what have you. Mm. Now it's much more transient. They'll bring people in to do it. But when you go into those workshops on a studio like Pinewood, and you see all these art craftspeople creating props and things like that, there is something just magical about that. And seeing all the craftsmen at work and smelling the, like you said, the sawdust and the vacuum sealed things, and it's wonderful. And all those people that do the work there, they're just incredibly skilled people, and that's why people come to Pinewood, I guess.
Yeah, there's an innocence to it where, you know, we'd walk around on a lunch break, and, you know, I had friends there that were there longer than me, so I'd feel like I was trespassing anytime I went through an alley, anytime you'd go through a corner of a studio. But no one bats an eyelid, because they all know you are working there in theory. And, you know, you just walk down a corridor and you look to the left or right of you, and there'd be iconic images, whether it's royals visiting to appear on a set. I mean, that happened when Prince Charles visited the No Time to Die set. There was like an email sent around to all the companies that offers saying, if you want to come out and wave to them, you can. It's not really something I did or would want to have done, but knowing that's going to be a photo shoot that's gone viral, and that's how they announced the V8 Vantage and the other cars to be in No Time to Die. It's an experience. And yeah, if anyone ever gets the chance, doesn't matter what it is, whether it's an interview, whether it's a tour, if you're ever lucky or they want to do it, any chance any human being is ever going to get to go there, you just got to do it. It's bucket list stuff, and it's an absolute privilege to be there.
One little trick is, I had a friend, in fact, it was the lady whose father sadly died when he was building planes there. She goes to TV recordings there. And whilst you don't fully, you know, it's not going to be the James Bond Jurassic Park style tour, but you just get the rhythms and the scale of it and the size of it as well. It always staggers me how every time I go back, it's bigger, and I'm like, that wasn't there before. We were very lucky that we got married there, because they kind of, I don't think we did anything wrong, but they kind of stopped weddings not long after we got wed there. And I was glad of that. It meant that we had that little window of time. But I remember our guests were late, because they were just, all the guests were at the gates like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Sort of. And we were told to bring passports for security. It's like, right, telling your whole 100 guests, you have to bring a passport. And it's like, why? And please, no wandering onto the sets, no wandering onto any Millennium Falcons. There's one cousin that may have to fess up on something, allegedly. But it's a great place, and I love it dearly.
Yeah, and one final thing for me for the Bond fans. If you are looking to go there, I said there's recordings. They have a screening room, the John Barry Theatre, obviously named after John Barry as well. And you can see new films there, older films there. They very rarely do it, but that's an opportunity for people to get the chance to go. And as you said, you know, being on a Bond podcast, the history of Bond, Pinewood is so essential to that story and what's sort of been with it since. And it's going to be really interesting moving forwards to see if the future Bond films will still film there. I think they will.
Well,
it's very interesting.
They will, because Eon still own the 007 stage, which we haven't mentioned, but that was the glorious 76 built, sort of, well, bigger than a cathedral. It's this massive, heavenly cornered hangar of Ken Adamness, and I love it. I've still yet to be inside. I've kind of gone round it, but not been inside, because they're usually blowing things up when I'm there, and it's always a little dangerous. But that's been a massive boost. You know, the amount of films that have shot on the 007 stage, Superman 3, Tim Burton shot Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory there. They built that whole set there. It is the stuff of magic, and it's great to see that such physical, practical cinema, is still needed. I think, in fact, Star Wars has kind of pushed it back to that practical edge, and Pinewood's still the star on that. But also, what also happens though is that Pinewood has helped other local studios, you know, the satellite studios. So you've got Longcross at Chertsey, and the Twickenham studios are still used. And so, you know, Kenobi, I believe, shot in little smaller hub studios around, and that. You know, Pinewood's not the rival, it's Pinewood is sort of the facilitator of that almost.
P is for Powell. Now, which Powell? There's a bit of a story behind this. So when I pulled together the list of people we're going to cover for the podcast, there's a lot of like cross-referencing, reference books and stuff. And what I'd put down for this was G. Powell. So I went to do my research, and it was like pulling a string. You know, when you pull the string and everything just begins to unravel. Because not only is there a Greg Powell that worked on the James Bond films, but also his brother, Gary Powell. So Greg and Gary Powell are brothers who come from a stunt family, and they have a very rich history with the Bond films and the UK film industry. So we've got Greg and Gary Powell. Their dad was a stuntman called Nosha Powell, and he had an extensive career in stunt work. And he was stuntman on 14 James Bond films, from Russia with Love up to A View to a Kill. And he also did Casino Royale 67, and he did stand-ins for Roger Moore and for Timothy Dalton. Greg and Gary Powell's uncle was a guy called Dinny Powell, who did stunts on Dr. No, on right up to GoldenEye and Casino Royale. And Dinny acted occasionally as the double for Sean Connery and Roger Moore. And then he went on to work on the films of Dalton, Brosnan and Daniel Craig. Now, it doesn't stop there. Greg's daughter, Tilly Powell, also worked on Skyfall and Spectre and did stunts on No Time to Die as well. So when I put down G. Powell, I mean, I just didn't know what I was setting myself up for here. But an incredible family. So I'll just give you a bit of a history on all of them here. So Greg Powell, he's an award-winning stunt performer, coordinator and second unit director. His Bond credits include Spy Who Loved Me, For Your Eyes Only, Never Say Never Again, View to a Kill, Living Daylights, World Is Not Enough, Skyfall and No Time to Die. But his bigger, wider credits cover Fast and Furious, Harry Potter, Jason Bourne, Mission Impossible, Indiana Jones, Doctor Who, The Bill, Superman, Supergirl, and Mark, you'll like this, even Supergran. So in an interview with... you prefer Supergran, do
you? No, Supergirl.
Oh, Supergirl. Okay. I thought you'd be of a Supergran vintage, but...
Oh, dare you, but you're very right. You're like very right, yes.
Like myself.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, I remember.
Exactly. So he started off, Greg Powell, doing trampoline explosions on the Spy Who Loved Me. And he's also in For Your Eyes Only. He gets shot by Molina with a crossbow. He did a fight with Sean Connery in Never Say Never Again that was cut, where he was thrown from a balcony. And he thought because he worked on that, he was going to get in trouble with the cubby for working on that one. But he worked on Octopussy as well. And then on The World Is Not Enough, he did a stunt alongside his brother Gary, where we crashed through a wall. And... yeah, his brother Gary is a British stunt coordinator, second unit director, and he has 40 years of experience in the film industry. And he is the one that now works on the James Bond films. He's the one that's sort of quite front and centre with Bond as it is now. In an interview that he did, he said, it was follow around in the family tradition or get kicked out. His Bond credits include GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, and he is stunt coordinator on Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre, and I think No Time to Die as well. But his wider credits include Red Dwarf, Braveheart, Mission Impossible, Saving Private Ryan, The Mummy, Band of Brothers, Harry Potter, Bourne, Spider-Man. And he said the first stunt he ever did was on a Carry On TV series, which I didn't know there was one. Mm. When he was 10 years old, he said he had to double for someone doing a horse riding stunt, quite a small person. But that was his break. And he did some of the tank driving on GoldenEye. And he also did the famous boat jump in The World Is Not Enough. Mm. So talking about that specific stunt on The World Is Not Enough, he says, when I was performing stunts, the bigger the stunts was the better for me, because they would get your heart pounding. When I did the barrel roll in The World Is Not Enough, it was a pretty tricky thing. I was going about 60 miles an hour and I went about 14 foot in the air. If the boat hadn't gone over and clipped the Sunseeker, that would have been a very nasty result. So quite a scary thought on that one. Talking about working with Pierce Brosnan, he said Pierce was great. I totally enjoyed my time working with him. He really puts the work in. And Gary Powell is known also for his collaborations that he did with Martin Campbell. He also did Green Lantern, working with Ryan Reynolds on that film. Mm. So talking from going from being a stunt performer to a stunt coordinator, he said it's a natural progression after doing so many years of stunts. People just carry on doing the stunts. Some people carry on doing the stunts themselves, but I just got to the point where I just couldn't do what I used to do. I was always known for doing a good job, so I didn't want to become like the boxer who had one fight too many. So that was it. Yeah.
There's a great film, and I think you guys have seen it. I know, Tom, you have, because I think you interviewed them at the time for Yahoo. There's this great documentary called Hollywood Bulldogs, The Rise and Falls of the Great British Stuntmen. And yes. the Powells are really like the spine of that documentary. It's on BritBox, and I urge you to see it. It was actually genuinely one of the best films I saw last year. It was kind of in my mental top 10. And it looks at the stuntman and stuntwomen fraternity of the British movie scene. And roughly like starting, like you say, like 40s, 50s, Nosha Powell. My God, I want to be called Nosha Powell. You know, if you're going to be called anyone, Nosha Powell. And I think, wasn't his mother in or someone, that their elderly aunt or grandmother was also a stuntman? She'd always like be the old lady falling down the stairs in 40s crime capers. And yeah, the whole Powell saga, or sorry, dynasty, is really reinforced in Hollywood Bulldogs. And it looks at that era of stuntmen through, going back to Pinewood, through that home county's British studio lens, you know, your ITC years of Avengers and all the Danger Man and all those TV 60s shows. And the thing that I found just staggering about it was the lack of health and safety. So you had... they literally would be, oh, we need someone to drive a car into a wall tomorrow. Well, my mate's got a driving license. Oh, we'll phone him up and he can come in the morning. And it was so casual. I mean, I can understand why some things had to be a little more legalized and put a bit more safety into it. But and these guys, it wasn't just in the 50s and 60s. They, like you say, the Gary Greg Powell, particularly, I think he was the guy that descended down the outside of the Odeon Leicester Square to launch the premiere of Living Daylights, with the ruse being that it was Timothy Dalton arriving for the premiere. And I remember Nico and going, welcome Commander Bond to Leicester Square, but it was actually one of the pals that did that stunt. So yeah, fascinating. And they're linked with Vic Armstrong, who's obviously one of the big Bond stunt coordinators, who was heavily involved in the Brosnans and The World Is Not Enough. But yeah, if you can, guys, check out Hollywood Bulldogs. It's a stunning testament to British pluck.
Yeah, I've not seen that. It's John Spira that directed it. He did Elstree 76, for anyone curious about some more behind-the-scenes stuff.
Which is also a great, great film. I love that film. It's got so much attitude, annoyance, and I can't believe they got away with the rights and the use. They kind of faked cine film behind-the-scenes stuff. Kind of beautiful. It's, yeah, John Spira does good stuff.
He's got a documentary series called Real Britannia as well, I believe, on BritBox, which is about the history of British cinema, which by all accounts is great. But I love seeing the behind the scenes extras with the British stunt performers, because like you say, they're all just no nonsense, like, you know, get the job done kind of guys. And to hear them telling their stories of, you know, being set on fire and the time they fell off the horse and broke their ribs and stuff, you just think,
proper God. Lads. And yeah. Actually, one of my memories of Pinewood is going for lunch at the hall there, and you'd see round the bar, which incidentally was where the Anglo-Irish Peace Treaty was signed. The bar at Pinewood Studios was a major piece of sort of British history happened, because it was a neutral zone. But when you having lunch there near the bar, they've got their sort of stuntmen league jumpers and hoodies on, and they're all holding pints. And I'm not saying they're drinking on the job, but I thought, oh God, that's how it used to be in the old days of like all the stunt men and women going off for a boozy lunch, then going back to beat the whatnots out of each other.
Right, that's the Powells. Incredible dynasty.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two, medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA-Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
Piers for Pushkin, General Leonid Pushkin, played by John Rhys-Davies. He made one and only one appearance in The Living Daylights opposite Timothy Dalton in his first Bond film, and succeeded General Gogol after five appearances from the Roger Moore era. One of the more interesting characters, and a lot to find out through the behind the scenes, and of course the actor as well, John Rhys-Davies, a legend in his own right. What I sort of found fascinating, talking about behind the scenes to begin with, which I didn't know, that the actor of General Gogol, Walter Gotha, was ill, and he was meant to play the role of Pushkin in the film. Of course, he'd been in the ones prior, but due to health, they created the character of Pushkin, and of course, General Gogol appears at the end of the film, which is a lovely moment in that respect. And I mentioned that he'd made one appearance in the Bond films. He was in the Michael Francis draft for GoldenEye. He was sharing a scene with Bond, and that didn't go ahead. And there was also claims of a cameo in License to Kill, which John Rhys-Davies also declined to take part in, which I found was quite fascinating. And I guess we can say, talking the living daylights with his character, he is what's believed to be an antagonist that becomes an ally in the film, very similar to the For Your Eyes Only. I know that has happened. There's a lot of repetition with the Bond films, which I think can be a great thing sometimes. And with John Rhys-Davies, to me, he just brings a gravitas to every film he's in. Whether that's because I saw this after Lord of the Rings and after Indiana Jones, I don't know. But he's always had a presence as an actor for me. And I found him one of the more interesting characters in The Living Daylights, if I'm being honest. I'm not the biggest fan of that film, but certainly the fake death, the sequence, is probably one of my favourite moments from the film, and a really great way of seeing Dalton build a relationship with other characters. I don't know if I'm alone in thinking that.
No, absolutely. I love that whole intrigue. I remember as a kid, it was really like, oh, okay, right. You know, it's sort of a bit of subterfuge and twist, which Bond doesn't do enough of sometimes. That sort of showing us something that actually isn't happening and then turning it on its head.
So if we're going to talk about John Rhys-Davies, he was born on the 5th of May, 1944, in Salisbury to Welsh parents. And they moved to Tanganyika at the age of three, with his dad being a colonial police officer, which I didn't even know there was a job like that, but that was incredible to find out. And his family would eventually move back to Wales, and he resided in the United Kingdom until the late 80s, where he moved to the Isle of Man and later New Zealand. So he marries his Anne Wilkinson in 1966 at the age of 22. And they had two children before they separated in the 80s, but they did stay close, remained friends until she passed away in 2010. And what I also found interesting, he was one of the very first students at the University of East Anglia, which enabled him to become a co-founder of the Drama Club and eventually won a place at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. The Royal Academy of Dramatic Art has a fair few amount of Bond alumni, but I'll just pick three out for you all: Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, and Diana Rigg. So there's not just Bond royalty there, there's royalty to the entire film industry. So it's really interesting to see him on that list with them. And he would then go in to start popping up primarily in TV and films across the 70s. One of his big breakthrough roles was in a BBC adaptation of the book I, Claudius, which is focused on the Roman Empire, also starring some British royalty at the time: Brian Blessed, Patrick Stewart, Derek Jacobi. And I guess we can say one of his biggest roles came in 1981, as he was cast in Raiders of the Lost Ark and played the role of Salah, and would again play him in The Last Crusade in 1989, also starring alongside Sean Connery for that one, which I would argue is probably his most famous role until he appeared in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and for sure.
A really interesting one. I'm very new to seeing The Untouchables for the first time, but he appeared in a 1993 TV series, which was only a few years after Sean Connery, of course, won an Oscar for that film, which I'm going to guess was just made on the back of there being a very successful film of the same name, the same story. But has anybody seen any of his stuff prior to Living Daylights, I guess, is my question, that's not Raiders?
Don't think so.
I've seen his stint on Question Time within the last 10 years, and if you can find it, that's kind of a glorious bit of television. I'll just leave it there. But yeah, I mean, he's quite a character, and obviously cinema and the entertainment industry needs characters like that. But he's quite a character. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Character is definitely one of the more interesting terms, I think, to use for this. If we want to quickly speak about Lord of the Rings, I guess this is, you know, what he's most famous for with his career. Now, of course, he played not just Gimli, but Treebeard as well across the three films. Mm. And without getting into in-depth on Lord of the Rings, because we know how long they are, one of the more interesting trivia pieces, which I think is one of those sort of trivia pieces that everybody knows now, he was the only member of the Fellowship to decline having the tattoo at the end of filming. So that the word nine, I think, was written in another language that was tattooed onto them. He declined it, and it was instead offered to who was credited as his stunt double, Brett Beattie, who did accept the tattoo. And in the last few years, it's come out that this stunt double, Brett Beattie, actually wasn't just his stunt double. He also ended up becoming a size double and a body double and new versions of the word double that I'd never heard of before. Because during filming, John Rhys-Davies suffered many allergies from the prosthetics on the makeup. His eyes would swell out and it would leave him unable to do some filming. So Brett Beattie actually was almost co-credited, but he didn't get the co-credit, which has serviced in the last few years, which is quite a shame, really, given how long those films went on for and the stories involved. It's quite a shame that he's an unknown from that series. And I couldn't find a date specifically, but with himself moving to New Zealand where the films did, he resides in Waikato. I couldn't get a date for that, but I would imagine that was around the time or just after Lord of the Rings came out.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to his stunt double, but it still only counts as one. Sorry, I have to say it.
That's great. And also just very quickly talking about not just his second role in Lord of the Rings, but sort of his career following then. Of course, he was the voice of Treebeard. And this wasn't his only foray into voice work. He has had quite a career across the decades, voicing characters across games, films, series, even adverts as well. So he's sort of had a very successful voice career, and he even did motion capture with Mark Hamill and Gary Oldman on a game in 2015, which I was very surprised by. And I was quite surprised by the amount of credits he had, not hearing of anything in a non-arrogant term. And he essentially came out and did an interview saying, "I get at least one script a week to consider and try to do as many things as I can in a year. You never know what's going to be good. I like to say yes to most things. I love work." I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but he can also be seen not just on Question Time, but he's on the convention circuit quite a fair amount, which is kind of where the really interesting story comes in for me. He's on a person. He's always reminded of my granddad. I've been to many conventions, and every single time I see him at one, he's there in a full suit with a shirt done up, top button. He's got a lovely tie on, and he's very professional. And when he meets his fans, he actually takes a lot of time out with them. He speaks about what they do for a living. And he's very old school, which is why it's incredible to see him on the convention circuit, because that is not somebody I'd ever expect to see on a convention circuit. But it's very interesting. And I really struggled to find interviews with him speaking about Bond. But I did find a couple of him speaking about the future of Bond over the years. So I've pulled a couple of quotes from them, because not everything, I think, can be said, given his
or should character. Be repeated.
Yes, that's the better term. But he first spoke after the infamous Daniel Craig post Spectre press tour, and to the Digital Spy. So the problem with Bond actors is they don't realise they have a short shelf life in that role. They feel bitter and confused, and they get stupid. They get involved with a character that is actually bigger than them and probably the biggest thing they will ever do. And that's a tough one. And he went on to say other things about future Bonds. But then in 2019, did an interview with The Express where he was promoting another film, but they asked him about Bond. And he said, "I love Timmy's Bond, of course, Timothy Dalton, but I really do think the current one is wonderful too." So he obviously backtracked on his initial Daniel Craig opinions as well. And that kind of rounds it out with him talking about James Bond with his character and himself.
Yeah, Pushkin's an interesting one, isn't he? I don't know if... would have been interesting to see him come back, but one and done, I think, is fine. He's got enough of a career. I think he's also done stuff in Marvel and DC as well, hasn't he? I seem to remember doing some research into him recently in the past.
Yes, a lot of animated roles stemming from the late 80s as well. So it wasn't just sort of post Lord of the Rings, and he has very much been involved with those. And he even, I think, did a live action project as well, whether he lended a voice to a live action project. But he's done a lot for it, which, again, I find very interesting. Given his upbringing with his sort of trained background, it feels, in the sort of the same way Mark Hamill in the early 90s was still known as Luke Skywalker, and he didn't really get the credit for his voice acting until the years that followed. It's really interesting seeing some of the older actors that were sort of not there from the beginning, but there that, were also famous for live action performances. And again, there were so many credits. A lot of it's like smaller New Zealand's TV series as well. And as you said, he just likes saying yes to work. The capacity, the quality of those projects, I do not know. And there's too many to even find out.
All right, let's move on then to another. It's a bit of a two for the price of one, this one, Mark.
Yes, Purvis and Wade, or Pervert and Suede, as they sometimes are jokingly referred to. But yes, Rob Wade and Neil Purvis, who have written or been credited with the last seven Bond films, more or less. And they're kind of been quite instrumental to the success and the backbone of the Craig era. But they came on board on, I believe it was The World Is Not Enough. And at the time, I think it's indicative of what Barbara Broccoli, producer, often does. She keeps her eye on a lot of social cinema, social cause cinema. And there was a cracking, brilliant film that ended up being used in schools and universities on various curriculums called Let Him Have It, which was a 1991 courtroom drama about a gross mistrial where a guy with learning difficulties was accused of murder, and I believe he ended up hanging for it. And it was one of the films that put Chris Eccleston on the radar. And it was, as I say, it was like these social realist early 90s movies that around the same time as Once Were Warriors, which Barbara Broccoli noted for what Lee Tamahori, the director, was doing. And Lee Tamahori obviously did Die Another Day with Purvis and Wade. Both born in the early 60s, one in 61 and the other in 62. Not bad timelines for ending up writing Bond, so they're more or less the age of the film franchise. They went to University of Kent, which I assume it might still have, but it always had a really, really good English and film studies department. I remember going there when I was looking at universities, and I really wanted to go there because at the time, they were the guys that had written Let Him Have It, which was kind of a big big British film, especially for me and my sort of sixth form indie British cinema obsessions at the time. But they met, as I say, they met at University of Kent and ended up becoming a writing double act. But their style and their tradition has often been, you know, they'll attend a meeting, they will go to Eon House and talk, but they'll split up and go in different coffee shops, different pubs, work on some material, then sort of bring it back to each other and then maybe swap. You look at what I've written, you look at what I've done, and just kind of collaborate that way. As someone that's done screenwriting and as a writer, I still find the idea of collaborating with someone absolutely terrifying because I just can't see it working. But they do make it work. And obviously there's a hell of a lot of brilliant, you know, Galton and Simpson spring to mind. There's a lot of great writing partnerships there. And these guys, they sometimes get a little flack. If someone doesn't like anything of the last seven Bond films, it's immediately Purvis and Wade's fault. And often, you know, it's sometimes a surprise. It's the biggest surprise when Purvis and Wade are announced as doing the next Bond. They are the most surprised because they never take it for granted. In fact, if you ask anyone, any of the composers, directors, they never take it for granted that they will be back. And that likewise goes for Purvis and Wade. I think they've been way more influential in the course and the quality of particularly the Craig era than we give them credit. And again, there's this assumption that, oh, they start, but they're not good enough and other people come in. That's not how it works. It's not how it works in many a big film franchise or even an indie script. But they have had, joining them through the Bond process, an amazing team of writers who have just shed a different light. Purvis and Wade bring the light of those dusty old Fleming pan paperbacks that are piled up in their script meetings that are moth-eaten, and they will refer to them, and there's always something. I'm glad they did the Garden of Death recently, because that was always they often referred to You Only Live Twice. There's always photos of Rob Wade writing a Brosnan script, and he'd have You Only Live Twice paperback sort of in the corner of the desk. They did a great, great film in 2005 called Stoned, which looked at Brian Jones, the Rolling Stone who didn't make the end of the 60s. And it's one of the best David Arnold scores as well. I urge you to try and catch the score. But it's cinematically introduced a little actor who I think played, my Rolling Stones cast list is gone dry. But anyway, Ben Whishaw crops up in the film. Oh, it's Keith Richards. He crops up in that one. And it was kind of one of the first films where Ben Whishaw became a thing. But the guys, as I say, they've worked with John Logan, Paul Haggis, Jez Butterworth, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Scott Z. Burns. They have worked with a lot of writers who don't get acknowledged in headlines or don't get screen credits. And I feel that they create the spine, they create the drive, they create the beats. And when someone comes onto a Bond, you know, when Phoebe Waller-Bridge came on to start work on No Time to Die, that was actually something that was already happening way before the announcement of the headline. And it's not, as I say, it's not that they can't do it. It's just that they understand, and that's very generous and creative as writers, that there are other people that can bring a different echo here. So Phoebe Waller-Bridge comes in, and, you know, how we're going full circle here. She touches up Ana de Armas, so to speak, and gives that whole sequence a beat and an economy and a zing. And in fact, the whole film, you know, when Phoebe Waller-Bridge came in to work with Rob and Neil on the film, it wasn't, she worked on all of the Daniel Craig stuff as well and gave it some bite and some sense of fresh comedy. They did Plunkett and McLean, which was another 1999 sort of Dick Turpin type highwayman film that I really loved at the cinema at the time when it came out. It came out at that end of, and in fact, they were very much part, cinematically, they were part of that 90s Britpop cinema, which we just assume is sort of Shallow Grave and Trainspotting and Four Weddings. But no, it was Plunkett and McLean. It was Human Traffic. It was Let Him Have It. And Purvis and Wade were often key to a lot of that. They also did the Bond spoof that is Die Another Day. No, sorry, that is Johnny English. and kind of took the rise out of Bond and all its accoutrements. And I think that must have been great fun for them, because they could do all the things that they couldn't get away with Brosnan and Craig. Len Dayton is one of their big obsessions. They did they co-starred an adaptation, SSGB, of one of his works. And I know Robert Wade socially a little bit, and I'm not going to say what that is, but the projects they've not done, the projects that were so near to production, are just beautiful. And I was like, oh my God, why was that not made? One was a Riviera type caper, like a jewelry caper. The title eludes me now, but it had a cracking title, and I remember talking to them about it, and they were doubtful it would happen. But I mean, and that's the thing, a lot of writers will work on it, whether it's a Bond, they will work on it, leave a thumbprint and move on. And I who knows what the new era of Bond will bring, but every film, every one of the last six Bond films, the assumption has been it won't be the two guys, and they have come on board. They've, as I say, they've been most surprised, and I think they've done great things. They helped steer No Time to Die, especially when it had, there was a lot of stop and starts on the script there, because Danny Boyle brought in John Hodge. They all parted company, apart from some of the production design team and the costume designer, and they've often picked up the pieces on a Bond. And I think they don't get enough credit or praise for that. So, yeah, again, big fans of the two guys. And they're great fun when you meet them as well. They're so sort of, I wouldn't say shy, but they're really unassuming. And I love them for that as well.
They're very interesting, that I think, I'm glad you mentioned that, they're almost easy targets for criticism now. And I think it's a shame, because their impact on these films, on this series, and making the jump into the 21st century, covering two eras that couldn't be more different. And to me personally, having success in both of those eras, I think it's sort of incredible. And, you know, as you said, not everybody expects to come back. And of course, if we'd have had the original No Time to Die, of course, the Daniel Boyle one, we wouldn't have had these at all. And it's really interesting. And you just got to also ask the question, there's a reason why they do get brought back. And it's because, you know, the Broccolis have the trust in them. And it's a very important quality for making these James Bond films. And I absolutely adore them. And, you know, whether they come back for a third era, I don't know. And I guess we'll find out in the coming years.
Yeah, that's something else that often people say, oh, why are they back again? And, you know, there is some snippy online sort of Greek chorus about these things. But when you're working on a film, whether it's a student low-budget film at the University of Kent in the 80s like they were doing, or No Time to Die at Pinewood, Cuba, and everywhere else, it's who you need to know you can get on with people. You need to know that they will bring the goods, that they won't flip out when you go, guys, we need a 15th redraft this month on that. You know, the Broccolis can bring them in and not panic or worry, or, you know, the Broccolis,
they can spend their time worrying about something else, right?
Yes,
they can pass that
exactly
on to the people they know that will do what they've asked them to.
Yeah, because often I've written feature length screenplays, and it's hard work. It must be easy when there's just two of them, but no, it's hard work. And the one thing you learn really, really quickly is you don't write, you rewrite. You know, anyone that's a writer is a rewriter. And I think that's where their skills get forgotten or overlooked. They clearly can take a Bond script and, oh my God, we've lost this location, but we've got a new sponsorship with a helicopter, a car, or a new bottle of champagne. can this be worked in? What do you think you could do? And they go to the Fleming novels, they go to their inspiration, you know, Len Deighton, as I said, Len Deighton, one of the 60s kind of literary peers of Fleming. They love him too, and you can see all of it in their work. And I would love them to do more. That's a great point. I would love to see what they did in the third age. I think there's the trilogy of Purvis and Wade with Bond is maybe not complete yet.
No, and they've still got, you know, what did you say? They're 60s, so they're the same age as the movies. You know, Richard Maybaum was writing Bond films up until, you know, 70, was he in his 70s when he wrote License to Kill? So that's interesting as well. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, they've learnt as well. I mean, World Is Not Enough is my least favourite Bond film. I find it hammy and over the top. It's still a great Bond film, but there's too much. There's too many characters in it. And you can see that they've learnt that. So it's pared down a bit in Die Another Day. And then the time we get to Casino Royale, the character scope is really shrunk. And I like seeing that self-awareness that they've learnt from their mistakes. And also, I remember when I did Catching Bullets, I kind of wasn't kind about one Bond film or a bit in it. And Robert Wade privately said to me, and I said, I'm so sorry I said that. And he went, no, you nailed what was wrong with that. So they're quite, you know, they're able to see what their mistakes were and more importantly, learn. And that's why producers bring back writers. They know that they're trusted, that they can learn, that they can support. And yes, we can worry about other things because Rob and Neil are in two separate pubs with two dirty old Pan Fleming paperbacks.
And Cubby obviously trusted Richard Maybaum. So, you know, I think that they obviously learn a lot from him and keeping that continuity.
Yeah.
And keeping it's almost like a continuation of that, isn't it?
Yeah. Keeping an in-house team of writers, whether it's Purvis and Wade or Maybaum, or even Michael Wilson. That's something for another discussion. Michael Wilson's writing input into the Bond films is grossly overlooked. His sense of story economy and getting to the beats. Likewise, Richard Maybaum. But there's often sort of the stalwarts, the regulars that work on Bond, who then will work alongside a newbie, you know, whether it's Tom Mankiewicz or John Logan. You know, John Logan wrote all the queer silver stuff in Skyfall. So I said to Rob, congratulations on having the line about, why do you think this is my first time? You know, every gay guy in that screening literally got to their feet and started applauding. And they said, no, that wasn't us. That was John Logan. And we were so glad he could come in. So, you know, often writing a Bond is a mixture of the familiar, I wouldn't say old and new, but the familiar and the new. And for that reason alone, maybe they might still be in the mix for Bond 26.
I would think so. Right. So let's end this podcast with a look at a character. P is for Pepper, Sheriff J.W. Pepper, played by Clifton James in Live and Let Die in The Man with the Golden Gun, From the Sublime to the Ridiculous. J.W. Pepper introduced in Live and Let Die and then returned for Man with the Golden Gun. Now, I found this quite amusing, but apparently United Artists ran a For Your Consideration campaign to have Clifton James nominated for a Best Supporting Actor at the 1974 Academy Awards, which would have been incredible. But interestingly, he always played like these Southern rednecks, but actually he lived in New York and was, by all accounts, quite well to-do guy. So it would have been, quite a stretch for him. But the character of Pepper was that the story of the film is that he was inspired by a corrupt local rural sheriff that Guy Hamilton had encountered on a road trip across America. And Tom Mankiewicz saw that idea and brought him in to break up that boat chase sequence in Live and Let Die. That's the official history of it. We covered a lot of this in our Live and Let Die episode, so you can return to that to get more on the boat and the boat sequence and J.W. Pepper. The actor Slim Pickens, who was in Dr. Strangelove, he had been considered to play J.W. Pepper. But the role was given to Clifton James by the casting director, Marion Doherty, who had seen him in a play called All the King's Men. Clifton James said he'd read it in about 5 minutes. They gave me the part and I flew to New Orleans the very next day. So he was just sort of flown straight into the shoot there. Mankiewicz later said that all those southern sheriffs looked there, down there, looked all looked exactly like Clifton James. Clifton would say, "Hello, boy," and all these sheriffs would be keep laughing and say, "God damn, you're funny." Later on, Clifton James said, "I just thought it was another job. I certainly didn't think it was anything special. I really didn't. I wasn't a big James Bond fan. I'd only seen one with Sean Connery. Of course, once I did it, I realised it was a big deal." However, there is a slight twist to the tale because earlier this year in 2022, the guys at MI6 published an article titled "The Genesis of JW." I don't know if either of you read this.
No.
So what they had discovered was that the character of J.W. Pepper had taken a little bit more than inspiration from another source, not quite the origins that Mankiewicz and Guy Hamilton had talked about. I think it probably played into it. It may not be the origin of it, but basically there was a character that had appeared in a series of TV commercials in the USA in the 2 years before Live and Let Die was made. So there was an actor, Joe Higgins. He'd been born in Louisiana and he was cast to play the role of Sheriff JW for a series of commercials for Dodge cars. And over the course of the campaign for this new Dodge Challenger, this Sheriff JW in the adverts, he sort of pulls drivers over for having racing cars, and then he learns how affordable the cars are, and he starts to tell the deputies about these amazing cars. But he's very much a carbon copy of J.W. Pepper as we get him in Live and Let Die. As they Dodge saw the success of these TV spots for their cars, they hired the actor, Joe Higgins, who played J.W., to be their safety sheriff. And he toured the country, appearing at motor shows and conventions, as well as speaking, appearing at high schools about driving, promoting the use of seatbelts. And you can watch these adverts online. So they're the Dodge car, and they're the character's called Sheriff JW. So they saw this character and thought he'd be a great fit for the Bond film, but couldn't use the actor, Joe Higgins, in the film because the character was associated with Dodge and the film already had a product placement deal with Chevrolet. So that is another wrinkle to the tale of J.W. Pepper.
I've always thought he always reminded me of Rod Steiger a bit in The Heat of the Night, because that was kind of the character at the time, that deep south, slightly rotund, Phil Mitchell-sized sheriff. I think there's a lot of influences coming into play there.
And definitely.
You're going to mention Superman 2, yeah?
It's coming. It's
good. Coming. All right, I will chew on my tobacco here and just wait for that moment.
Clifton James, he was a very decorated World War II veteran, actually. He had served for 4.5 years in the South Pacific and was decorated with a Silver Star, Bronze Star, Purple Heart, Presidential Unit Citation, Combat Infantry Badge, and 6 Battle Stars. So he really did his tour of duty there. After leaving the military, he started acting in a college in Oregon and married in 1948. But his acting career then spanned 5 decades, including appearances on stage, TV, and film. Credits on TV include Dallas, the TV series, and his films include Superman 2, Bonfire of the Vanities, The Last Detail. He's in The Untouchables, another mention for that film, and he's also in 8 Men Out. And his last film credit came in 2006, Raising Flag, that film was called. But like I said, often being cast as a Southerner, but he was lived in and around New York for most of his career. He said about appearing in James Bond, "I've done so many more things that I think are more important, but it turned out to be the most famous thing I ever did. And now I'm a damn legend. People still stop me and say, oh, and who's sad?" And James, he remained a big Bond fan, and saw the Daniel Craig things. Daniel Craig films, he said, "I saw Daniel Craig in the last one and he was awfully good." He sadly died in 2017 at the age of 96. And Roger Moore paid tribute saying, "Terribly sad to hear Clifton James has left us. As J.W. Pepper, he gave my first 2 Bond films a great fun character." So there we have it. He's quite a rare occurrence in the Bond world of an actor playing a character that appears in 2 films. Mm, and only 2 films.
yeah, his second appearance is a little, let's say, racially delicate. You're like, oh, you know, Bond, despite appearances, avoids a lot of, oh, that's aged bad. It's not, there are enough moments, but there's not loads like a lot of cinema and eras could depict. But yeah, some of the comments in Man with the Golden Gun are a little icky, but that's the passage of time, nothing that was wrong at the time. I would love to have seen him a bit more. I wonder if we could recast him. That's maybe an online thing. Who, yeah, if Sheriff Pepper came back, who would play him now? I don't know. Jack Black. No, it's too easy. It's got to be someone cleverer.
Oh, it's yeah. Probably like Josh Gad or something, wouldn't it?
Oh God, yeah, Pepper Jr. Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Matthew McConaughey, done, sorted. No, I'm not joking. If Miles Teller is my future dream, Felix Leiter, so him opposite Matthew McConaughey, Sheriff. There we go, sorted.
That's it, job done.
You could just have him come from Top Gun, Miles Teller. That'd be perfect. Same costume, done. You know what? The one thing I love about Sheriff Pepper is I was never the biggest fan of his characters, but it's until last year I grew a more respect for him. And I think he's got severely underrated chemistry with Roger Moore. They're a great double act in their own right. And it's very rare for Bond to have that when it's not Bond with Felix or a villain, if that makes sense.
Yeah. He really brings the sequences he's in to life. They really sort of start to sparkle when he's on screen, regardless of what you think of him. There are like more incongruous characters that pop up in Bond, but he is nothing if not unforgettable, I think. And for that, I do like him. But I think, Mark, you're right. In Man with the Golden Gun, it gets pushed a little bit too far.
Yeah, but then it's also, I mean, that's a Mankiewicz thing. Mankiewicz loved to send up America. And Clifton was one of his best vehicles for that. So, yeah, he's sending up the deep south, slightly racist sheriff. And it's a great beat because it's actually quite a brave beat as well to sort of, you know, have this very white Roger Moore and this you know, grizzled old spitting sheriff. And it's the black fraternity of actors and stuntmen in that film that become the heroes and become the drive of it, whereas he's just there. As a sort of, you know, I think it's not accidental that there's that the thing with the elephant and the Republicans in Thailand. You know,
yes.
That's this whole thing. I can't remember his wife's name on the top of my head, but the way he just says his wife's name, I'm just like, oh, we've all slightly met those people and those attitudes. But yeah, that was Mankiewicz spoofing America and spoofing that sort of post Nixon hang-ons, which, you know, you could say is quite a Trumpy thing. I want to think Sheriff Pepper wouldn't be a Trump voter. Is it make Louisiana great again? Like, I can't see him doing that.
It's a good question. It's like gullible, isn't it? And I think it'd be interesting to see how to fit into it.
Well, I'm almost sad that Brendan's coming back next week. You two have been excellent guests. Thank you very much for joining us on the HZ podcast. What are you working on at the moment?
On Cinema Saver, we are just past the halfway point in a Steven Spielberg retrospective. So every single Tuesday, we are going through his directed films in chronological order. So if you're a fan of Steven Spielberg or blockbusters or the film industry, come on over, have a look at that, alongside many other things, TV reviews, news discussions, and new releases. But mainly Spielberg. Lots of James Bond talk in the Spielberg films, of course. Indiana Jones being created off the back of not being able to do a James Bond film.
Yeah, I can recommend the Last Crusade episode. It's very good.
Yeah, we have two very good guests on there, both called Tom. One might be on this video, who knows?
And Mark, what are you up to at the moment?
Apart from losing my mind trying to move house, but also in happier ways planning for a big California trip. So I'm going to check out the facilities at Drax Enterprises. But very nice. I've circling a third book that might be Bond shaped but with a little difference, also writing for that great institution that is Yahoo Entertainment. Thank you, Tom. I've also been a consultant producer on a new Bond documentary that I think people will be talking about in sort of a few months to come, called The Other Fellow, which is a really interesting look at what happens if you actually call James Bond. So I've been glad to sort of help that one out the gates a little bit in recent times.
Great. Well, we're hoping to speak to the people behind that film soon as well. So
yeah, you should.
Yes, we will. But yes, so if people want to get hold of us, if you want to email the show to let us know some of the trivia we got wrong, some characters that appeared more than that twice by the same actor, then you can email us at podcast@jamesbond.co.uk. Or you can find us on social media at James Bond A to Z on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, where you'll find us chatting away on about all things Bond. So just leaves me to say thank you, George Aldridge.
No, thank you so much for allowing me to come on.
And thank you, Mark O'Connell.
Not at all. Thank you. Thank you.
And the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingermals and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Here's Bridges, 2 miles back.
What the hell are you doing now, boy?
A bridge is that way!
You're not thinking
I sure am, boy.
Ever heard of Evel Knievel? Neither have I, actually.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.